morning, good afternoon, or good evening, and welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio, the podcast where we talk with writers about their lives, their craft, their business, and their latest work. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and our podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks. Bookmarks is a literary nonprofit whose programs include the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas. Come visit Bookmarks at our community gathering space and nonprofit independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Inside the Writer's Studio is also proud to be an affiliate of Libro FM, the audiobook platform that supports your local independent bookstore. Stay tuned at the end of the podcast for more information on Libro FM and a special offer. Cool. My guest today is Lauren McBrayer, whose novel, Like a House on Fire, has just been published. Lauren, welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you have a law degree, you have a job with an entertainment company. Tell us a little bit about the path that led you to become a novelist.
It's a windy road, as it is for, I know, so many writers. I would say that I always knew that I was a writer and that I wanted to figure out a way to do that professionally. But as a college student, you know, with debt and the need to make money and pay bills, I looked ahead at my life graduating from college and thought, like, I don't know how to do this. I need to do something to pay my bills. So I went to law school, as you do when you're trying to figure out how to make money, you take on a bunch of additional debt. But I went to law school to try to, you know, find a way for myself and convince myself that being an artist and being a writer, you know, wasn't practical. So I went to law school, you know, got a job at a law firm doing entertainment law, was sort of set up to pursue this path, and just felt this kind of ache inside of me that this isn't what I want to be doing, you know, full time with my life. So I started writing pretty early after starting my career as an attorney. And it started with young adult novels. I published three of those under my married name years ago. And it was always this thing that I did on the side, you know, that I did to sort of save my life and to give me sanity and all these things while I had this completely separate professional, you know, identity. But about 3 years ago, I knew I didn't have any more young adult novels in me. I wasn't sure, you know, what to do. I was feeling really creatively stifled. And the idea for this book arrived like a gift. And it's very different from my previous work, but it feels completely in harmony with who I am as a creator. So I'm excited for what's next. I just say that to aspiring writers, both, you know, it doesn't have to be your main job. It doesn't have to be your first job, but the things you ultimately end up writing don't have to be the things that you write first, you know, where you sort of like wet your whistle as an artist. I sort of do that and then get to the place that you think you belong.
Now, this was, my wife will vouch for me when I say this, this was pretty much a one sitting novel for me. I just ripped through this thing in an afternoon because I couldn't put it down. And it's one of those novels where I would really love to talk about the ending, but we are not spoilers here at Inside the Writer Studio. So we're not going to talk about the ending. I'm just going to tell my listeners, oh my God, the ending. Okay, so I'll just leave it at that. But so without any spoilers, tell us a little bit about what Like a House on Fire, what the novel is about.
Yeah, great. It is the story of a woman named Merritt, who, when we meet her, is in her, you know, mid to late 30s. She's a wife and a mother. She has a perfectly nice, and I don't even mean that in a condescending way, but a perfectly nice husband who was her college sweetheart. She has two young kids, and she's coming back to the workforce after taking several years off to attempt a painting career, which has failed sort of epically. And she thinks, you know, I'm kind of in the doldrums, as you are with young kids and trying to be a work from home mom and artist. So she thinks, I'll go back to work to try to get my spark back and to get my mojo back and remember who I am outside of these roles that I play at home. What she doesn't expect is that it's not going to be the job that lights her back up, but the woman that she meets at her job, a woman named Jane, with whom she forges a really unexpected and intense friendship that over time develops into something more. Yeah. And at the ending, you know, you mentioned the ending, and again, no spoilers. I love that you don't give them. you know, there's, I don't think it's too much to give away that the ending, that there is an epilogue. So there's a time jump in the end of the novel, and some readers, as you do with an epilogue, feel like they want to know what happens in that period of time between the last chapter and the epilogue. And I was talking about this with a friend recently, that the thing obviously readers don't know is that epilogue was the product of the weekend before this book went out on submission to publishers. It was ready to go. Manuscript was like packaged up in an email, ready to send to go out with it. My agent was ready to take it out. And I just felt this kind of nagging feeling inside. I was like, this isn't how it ends. There's more. So I sat down and wrote what became the epilogue in one sitting.
Yeah.
Didn't lift my fingers off the keys, sent it to my agent and said, what do you think about adding this as an epilogue? She's like, we have to include it. And in all of the edits that happened with Putnam, my publisher, after that, not a single word of that epilogue changed. So, yeah.
It's just great when you have those writing moments, and readers will find out. I mean, it's absolutely dynamite. It would be a very different novel without that. One of the first things that happens when these two main characters meet, Merritt and Jane, is that Merritt, and this is one of the first things that happens in the novel, Merritt is comparing herself to Jane in some significant detail. What do you think the reader learns about Merritt and her character from her sort of compulsion to compare herself to this other woman?
I think that's a great question. And I think there are a few things that we're meant to learn about Merritt from that. I think the first is just about the female experience in general and sort of the conditioning that we have to feel less than and to feel like there's something on the to-do list that we haven't hit. And in the beginning of the novel, some of the things that Merritt notices about Jane most immediately are her, you know, fashion sense and the way that she dresses and how put together she looks, and also how in shape her body is. You know, Jane is 20 years older than Merritt, but works out a lot and takes good care of herself physically. So Merritt feels both out of shape and unfashionable in Jane's presence. And so, you know, I wanted to just play with that thing that happens among women where it's like, oh, she's doing something that I'm not doing, and I need to add that to the things that I'm doing, you know, on top of Merritt's job and her family and her art and all the things. But also I wanted that comparison to function as a marker, an early marker of Merritt's queerness. I think that for women who haven't grown up identifying as gay or didn't think that being gay was a possibility for, you know, cultural or family reasons or lifestyle or whatever it is, I think that, and in my own experience, that sort of comparison, am I attracted to her or do I want to be her, I think is a thing that functions a lot in women who are sexually fluid or maybe, you know, don't realize the fullness of their sexuality. So I wanted us to notice that, to say, you know, Merritt, she has this kind of intense attraction and almost chemical reaction to Jane. And the only category she has for that is to say, you know, oh, either I envy her or I aspire to be like her, or, you know, to kind of rein it in, as opposed to acknowledging like, oh, I'm staring at her butt because I like looking at her butt, not because I want to go to the gym tomorrow and like do a bunch of squats. So,
yeah, there's, I've read a lot of novels lately and rightly so about, sort of the search for identity, which I think is part of what's going on in this novel. And some of that is gender and sexual orientation, and some of it is other things, but it sort of takes me back to a speech I heard Laverne Cox give some years ago at my younger child's college graduation about that search for identity is not something that you get to the end of and you're like, okay, I found it. This is who I am. Bing, end of discussion. That it's more of a moving target, that it's something we should, questions we should be always asking ourselves throughout our lives. Can you talk a little bit about how that idea of changing identity sort of plays into the novel for both of these characters?
Yeah, I think for Merritt, she has come to a place in her life where, at least in the beginning of the novel, she doesn't feel entitled to ask these questions about who she is anymore. You know, she's reached a point in her life where she's kind of quote unquote settled with the marriage and the kids and the loft apartment in San Francisco, and even this new job that she gets at the start of the novel. And it's sort of, who am I to to question all of it, to ask who I am, that feels self-indulgent, that feels selfish, you know, all those things. But once she meets Jane and she experiences these unexpected feelings for her and this awakening of a desire that feels really organic to her person and not something laid on her by culture or, you know, society, she starts to ask, you know, what do I really want? Who am I really? And she makes a lot of mistakes in the novel. And I think that that is great for self-discovery when you really mess up. But so because of her relationship with Jane, she starts questioning, you know, what do I want? Who am I? And what I think we see once she and Jane, you know, develop their relationship is that Merritt is now a person who will continually ask those questions, just as you say. And it's this awareness that we are ever changing, and this lie that we become a thing and we stay that thing keeps people, I think Merritt realizes, unhappy and, you know, and stuck. Yeah. So I think the answer to your question is it, yes, we are always ever becoming. We forget that as humans. And I think women in particular forget that when they settle into these, you know, preordained roles that women are supposed to play. But then once we come alive, we realize that there's beauty in the ever shifting and the constantly evolving. And Merritt kind of submits to that in the second half of the novel and allows herself to imagine 1,000 different outcomes to her life, which she had never before.
So when we meet her, Merritt is, she's got, as you say, 2 small children. She's married to this guy, Corey. And to me, Corey seems at the outset, at least, more interested in fulfilling his own needs than in, or his own perceived needs, at least, than he is in fulfilling those of his wife and his kids. But so tell us a little bit about that marriage and also about how, because I think you did such a good job of this. You managed to make Corey believable and even at times likable, you know, not allowing him to sort of slide into that cartoonish stereotype of the bad husband. Even though at times, obviously, we can see that he's maybe not making the greatest choices for his marriage. How did you strike that balance?
It took a lot of effort, actually, to do that, because I was dealing with a few tricky elements, some of which you hit on. You know, they don't have a perfect marriage. I wanted them to have a familiar marriage to readers. I wanted it to resonate with women and with men who are sort of in the average relationship, I think. But it's a book that involves, I don't think this is a spoiler, you can probably guess from the summary, it's a book that involves infidelity. Yeah. And I wanted to be careful to both not give Merritt sort of a free pass because her marriage is so bad that you're like rooting for her to cheat. But at the same time, I wanted the reader to understand just the feeling of loneliness and isolation that she feels within the context of this marriage. And so I wanted it to try to strike the balance. I tried to give her a husband that you would understand the desire to want something more, but also, you know, to be critical of Merritt in her choices. I just tried to give Corey as much humanity as possible in the writing of him. He's a guy who, you know, is well-intentioned, but he is really focused on his career, which, you know, a lot of husbands and men are, and he's fairly avoidant emotionally. We don't learn a lot about Corey's upbringing or his family, but, you know, what I know of him as a character is just, you know, he comes from divorced parents who didn't take a lot of time to get to know him. So he threw himself into academics and performance and a career. And so he's doing the best he can. You know, he doesn't have the skills to really engage with Merritt the way that she wants. And it's not his fault, but at the same time, I wanted to ask the question, does Merritt just have an obligation to spend the rest of her life with a partner like this?
Yeah.
Or is she allowed to want something more and to want something different than she wanted at 20 years old?
Yeah. It feels to me like in some ways, Merritt needs Jane's prodding in order to have the perspective to realize the tedium that her marriage has become. Can you comment on that dynamic, both in life and in the novel, that sometimes we need other people's perspectives looking back on our lives in order to give us an honest look at ourselves?
Yeah, absolutely. In my own life, this has been very true, that it's been girlfriends, you know, close friends over the years, who both point out things that I don't see about my relationships and myself, but also they kind of bear witness to my experience to say, here's what you've said over time. You know, here's what I'm hearing. Here are the themes that are consistent over the years. Which, you know, as humans, we like to tell ourselves stories that keep us happy and keep us content. And I think sometimes we forget our own unhappiness in an effort to sort of muscle through. So I wanted Jane to do that, to sort of reflect back to Merritt what she sees and what she hears. But also I wanted Jane to see Merritt the way that Merritt could ultimately see herself. You know, Jane doesn't care that Merritt's a wife or a mother or a PTA mom or any of the things that Merritt does in her separate home life. Jane sees Merritt as just a woman who's a talented architect, who's funny, who's sort of clumsy and quirky. And from the outset, she just likes her. You know, I mean, she just sees her and is like, I like you as a person. You haven't had to do anything or prove anything to me to earn it. We just have a rapport and a chemistry. And I wanted that to function as a gift for Merritt, for her to sort of like have this relationship in her life with someone she really admires and respects that she hasn't had to work for. And she just got, just as a grace. And then from there, that their relationship deepens and grows, and it becomes so much more. But I it was important to me that Merritt didn't, you know, perform a role that Jane, you know, liked her for. Jane doesn't like Merritt because she kills it at work in their first meeting. She likes her in her first interview before she's opened her portfolio. And I think that there's something really beautiful about that, both as a romantic storyline, but also as just humans connecting, to just lay it all down and be like, wow, somebody just likes me just because of me, you know?
You talked about female friendship, which I think, you know, plays an important part in this novel. And I think in what's behind this novel. And keep in mind, I'm asking this question as a man. But do you feel like, are there things that only a female friend can understand? Is female friendship a necessary and important part of a healthy marriage, or does it sometimes become something that fills the void in a marriage that's not working?
For me personally, it was the latter. So mm-hmm. I think it absolutely can become that. It's funny, your question hits on one of the sort of sparks for this story, the initial ideas. It was this concept of an emotional affair, and how if you understand yourself to be a straight woman and your husband understands you to be a straight woman, there isn't a concept of an emotional affair. You know, husbands aren't accusing their wives of having inappropriate intimacy with their girlfriends. Yeah. In fact, I think a lot of husbands feel relieved that their wives have an outlet for all these conversations or self-navel gazing or inquiry that, and I don't mean to be stereotypical or to generalize, but you know, many men don't want to engage that way. That's all the tropes and kind of stereotypes of women sitting around gabbing. So for me in my own life, my female friendships absolutely filled a void. You know, what I wasn't getting out of my marriage, I went and sought from friends, you know, not thinking it would ever be, could ever be romantic or sexual, because I didn't, you know, identify that way. But I think what happens is, it's not that intimacy is a zero-sum game exactly, but I think it's true that there is a person with whom we have the deepest form of intimacy, and that when we commit to that with somebody, it's by definition to the exclusion of others. And so if a woman does that with her best friend and not with her husband, her relationship with her husband will suffer on an intimacy level. You know, maybe for them, that's great. Maybe that enables them to stay married for longer, or, you know, every marriage looks different. But I think we do need to recognize what happens when our primary, you know, intimacy relationship isn't our marriage. And so the question I wanted to ask with this novel is, what if two straight women who had this intense bond, what if they suddenly realized that there was no limit to their friendship? You know, we think that like sex and romance is off the table. So if they've gotten so close, and then they realize in a moment that what they thought was a wall was actually a door, and there was more to discover, like what would happen. Yeah. So that was the what if that drove the novel. And quite frankly, I didn't know what would happen. You know, I asked the question in the novel and thought in the beginning that maybe Merritt and Jane would have one moment where they crossed over and then they realized, like, oh my gosh, what are we doing? Like, let's go back to our marriages. But no, spoiler alert, that's not what happens, obviously.
So when Merritt is sort of looking back on her marriage, she notes a time, and I'm quoting here, time when she'd taken an interest in herself and her husband had quietly opted out. So it's almost like she's sort of looking back at this inflection point in her marriage when she realized that she was, you know, an individual and he was kind of less interested in that. And that inflection point takes place before the novel begins. And I wanted to ask you, you know, as a writer, what is a challenge of putting an important point like that prior to the beginning of your narrative and still having it sort of work as it does in the context of the book?
Yeah, great question. It's tricky. I mean, the answer is the two choices are embedded in that choice. One is the decision to have the bulk of the sort of like inflection point is a great way that you put it, but just kind of the problems that arose with Merritt and Corey, you know, I put those before the novel begins. It's already there. But also to kick off the relationship, to push off the relationship with Jane and Merritt as it develops to what it develops, it's much later in the novel. There were two choices there that I wanted to kind of have Merritt and Corey's marital problems be a prelude, but I also didn't want to put Merritt and Jane's relationship, you know, sort of the sparks that arise between them at the beginning of the novel. And I made those choices for two reasons. One, because I didn't want to make the novel entirely about Merritt's marriage. This isn't a story about a marriage exactly. You know, Merritt's marriage is part of it, but it's ultimately a story about Merritt, which relates to the other part of it. It's a story about Merritt and Jane, absolutely, and it's a love story. But the bulk of the novel is actually Merritt's experience with herself and sort of coming to terms with what has already happened in her marriage, who she is now, and ultimately who she wants to be. So I think in the present, it was important for me to have, you know, a good chunk of the novel where Merritt is not being activated by either of these relationships, you know, in a plot-driven, dramatic way. There's not some fight with Corey that she's reacting to, and there's not some proposition from Jane that she's reacting to. So, you know, as for how it works in the novel, I think it's a bit tricky, you know, having it off the page with everything that's happened with Merritt and Corey, particularly in a third person limited point of view where we're only hearing Merritt's perspective. There's a sense of, you know, maybe Merritt's been unfair to Corey. There's a sense of maybe Merritt hasn't communicated enough to him. All of which I think are fair, you know, fair criticisms or comments, but I think it's also the way so many of us function. You know, we're in our own head and we don't communicate well. So I was trying to also, you know, capture that in Merritt's point of view.
So your two main characters, Merritt and Jane. Merritt is in her 30s and Jane is in her 60s. They're separated essentially by a generation. What both opportunities and challenges as a writer do those ages and those relative ages present to you?
Yeah, I remember when I first started working on this novel, I was pitching it to somebody and a male friend who said, "Don't you think you'd get more sales if they were 20 and 40 and not 40 and 60?" Which, you know, I either punched him in the face or laughed. No, just kidding. I wanted to look at female aging in this novel. I was approaching 40 myself when I first started writing it. And I had friends who were older, you know, a range of ages above me. And I was interested in the effect that those relationships have on my own identity and my own aging. And so the age difference between Merritt and Jane, I think, first of all, it allows us as readers, but also them, to question this idea that we get along best with people who are in the identical life circumstance with us, that women with young kids who are in their late 30s should be friends with women with young kids who are in their late 30s, and that that's who they're going to be seen by. For Merritt, that's absolutely not true. But I also wanted to look at how Merritt experiences her own aging as she looks at Jane, this woman that she finds beautiful and compelling and, you know, so attractive and all of these things. She's 20 years older, you know, and Merritt's looking at her own face and thinking, do I need Botox? Should I get filler? I need to go to the gym more. So anyway, the age difference between them, I think, is both supposed to be illuminating for Merritt. It's supposed to ask some questions about female aging and our experience of that. And then also to break down this idea that we're only going to be close with people who are exactly like us, which I think is a cultural lie.
There's a point in the novel when Merritt and Jane are sort of patching things up after a disagreement. And Merritt says, sometimes it's hard to separate myself from you. What does she mean by that? And what, you know, talk about that moment of realization that she comes to when she says that.
Yeah, it's interesting when you write a love story. I was just trying to be as authentic as possible to the experience of what it's like to fall in love with someone. It's not necessarily a prescription for the healthiest merging of humans. I think it's very true that Merritt and Jane lose their boundaries with one another in both very literal surface ways. You know, they're colleagues and they don't have boundaries. They speak to each other in a way that is not quote unquote appropriate. But also as they get closer, they do kind of merge and they feel each other's feelings and they're very wrapped up with each other. And the choice to do that was just trying to be authentic to that experience. You know, Merritt in a lot of ways is coming of age in this novel. She's approaching 40, but in her discovery of her own queerness and these feelings for Jane, she becomes very young emotionally. You know, she's never felt like this about anybody, and she certainly never felt like this about a woman. So I just wanted to give voice to that experience of when you fall for someone, it's sometimes hard to know where you end and where they begin. And it's just part of that experience of falling in love, particularly for the first time.
So one of the choices you make in this novel that sort of really complicates things, if we just had a woman who was in a sort of unsatisfactory marriage and she meets somebody who seems perfect for her, you know, we can kind of go along with that. It's a fairly easy decision what you ought to do. But Merritt has two small children. And this complicates her life in lots of ways. First of all, just this push and pull that comes with anybody who is both a parent and somebody who is trying to pursue a career. Can you talk about how that tug of war sort of works for and doesn't work for Merritt?
Yeah, I think that the issue for Merritt is that she's been, and this is on her, you know, operates on a subconscious level for her, I think. She feels that she's been complicit in this life that she has. You know, Corey's under no illusions that she's, you know, perfectly happy and singing tra-la-la in a field every day, but she hasn't complained. You know, she's sort of, as I said before, you know, muscles through. And she has this belief that there's not more that you can expect out of life. You know, she has these kids and she has this husband and she has this amazing apartment. She's aware of her own privilege. You know, she doesn't want to be a whiny brat, you know, who's dissatisfied. And there is this great push and pull between who she is as a mother and a wife and who she is as a woman outside of that. And also then who she is as an architect. I think, you know, all of these are roles that she plays professionally, personally, and then the parts of ourselves that are neither our job nor our relationships. And all of these aspects of Merritt are in a push and pull in this novel, you know, which is going to be dominant? Who is it that I am really? Which of these roles are choices I've made, and which of them are things that have just been laid on me? I think for Merritt, the question is, you know, what do I really want and who can I really be? And, you know, there are moments when she's not an amazing parent, but there are also moments where she's a fantastic parent. I mean, she loves her sons very much. She is the dominant parent for them at home, you know, and so I think the push and pull for Merritt is, how do I do all of these things that I've learned how to do without losing myself in the midst of it? So to the question of like, yes, if she were married and hadn't had kids, maybe we could come along in a journey that, you know, she should leave, you know, or what have you. But I don't think the question resolves. I mean, obviously, as the way the novel turns out, just because she does have kids.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it doesn't, if the kids are the thing, then what does that say about women's autonomy and agency? You know, if you have kids, you should make different choices for yourself than if you didn't. I mean, probably culturally, we believe that. But I think Merritt realizes that that's a lie, which is why she ultimately makes different choices.
In addition to having this push and pull between being a working parent and having a career, she also has this push and pull between having an artistic identity, an artistic impulse, and an economic necessity. She loves to paint, she loves to create, but she needs to make money. How does she balance that, the creative and the economic, in her life?
I think for Merritt, like for many of us, including myself, our identity and our existence is a constant balancing act, as you say. We're sold this bill of goods that we're supposed to be everything, and it's all supposed to fit perfectly under some umbrella of female identity, that we're supposed to be good parents and good wives and good at whatever profession we seek out, but also that can't bleed into the other aspects of our life. We're also supposed to be a good friend. And Merritt is just embodying the reality that it's not that easy, that, you know, we don't pursue the thing that we love and become immediately successful. We don't necessarily feel completely fulfilled by our professional life or our roles as wife and mother. And so she's constantly just sort of rejiggering and trying to recalibrate and trying to find herself in the midst of it and trying to be, you know, all of the things that she actually is. And I think at the beginning of the novel, Merritt has this sort of feeling of failure, and she's going back to a job she doesn't like because she hasn't been able to do the thing that she really wants to do, which is make art. But in meeting Jane and experiencing being an architect under the wing of this incredible woman who draws freehand instead of using computer programs, Merritt sees the possibility of integration, that I could be an artist and also have a professional career, and there's a way to integrate. And I think that that's what happens personally for her. You know, she sees a way of integration. I can be all of the things that I am when I'm with this woman that I haven't felt at home. So the question Merritt begins to ask herself is like, which life do I want? Do I want a life with Jane, or do I want a life with Corey and the kids? But the point is, that's a false binary. It's not an either or, because, and Merritt sort of begins to grapple with this and begins to unravel a little bit, because it's actually both and, because she's a person who wants a life with Jane, but also wants a life with her sons, of course, and also wants a continuing relationship with her husband, though it needs to change to make room for who she's discovered herself to be.
Yeah. One of the other things I love that happens vis-a-vis her painting is that as she becomes more sort of honest about who she is and what she really wants, and we see her painting a little bit, suddenly the paintings are much more honest and artistic and beautiful, because she's being true to herself as an artist, you know.
Absolutely. I think that's a theme that runs throughout the novel, is when Merritt is authentic and true to herself, beauty arises, you know. I mean, I think in the personally and on the canvas.
So I talked to a lot of writers who come from an academic background. They maybe teach creative writing, things like that. But you, as you've said, come from more of a law business background, and you use that, I think, to great advantage in this novel. Can you talk a little bit about how your own experience in the business world helped you kind of create the world of Merritt's career, which is where a lot of this relationship is playing out?
Yeah, I think, you know, Merritt's relationship with her own profession and her own academic path is something that I drew heavily on from my own experience. both, and this isn't your question exactly, but both the sense of like, you make all these choices that you think are going to expand your options by going to a really great school, by getting a graduate degree, by moving to a city that has a lot of opportunity. But actually what happens is all of those choices narrow your possibilities because you take on debt, you live in an expensive city, you've become a specialist in a particular career. And then you wake up one day and you've succeeded in landing in this life that you've built for yourself, but begins to feel a bit like a cage. So I wanted to give voice to that and sort of the experience of us, of those of us who have pursued an academic path and a business path, that can be confining because you end up in a career that like you can't, it's harder to abandon. So I think that's definitely something there in terms of, as a writer, my experience as a lawyer, I think helped with the structure of this book. You know, as attorneys, we're trained in law school to structure argument and you write briefs for court and you figure out how to get from A to B in a really, you know, structured, logical way. And I hope that that comes through, you know, in the novel in terms of how I've crafted it, because I definitely feel that my legal brain, was part of the structure of this story.
Merritt has, I think it's fair to say, a complicated relationship with religion. And this is one of the things that really struck me about this novel, because that's it, when I read other novels that are, you know, I won't say like this, but that are sort of appealing to a similar demographic or maybe dealing with similar issues, this is something that very often gets left out. It's just easier to, you know, ignore it instead of introducing this other element. But I think it really helps you create her character. Can you talk a little bit about the role that religion and that God plays in her life and why you wanted to layer that into this novel?
Yeah, it was really important to me to give Merritt a faith tradition and a faith, you know, relationship to faith. I think in part because it's true to so many of us, you know, so many people have a relationship with the higher power, with the divine. For many of us in America, it's grounded in Christianity. For Merritt, it's grounded in pretty conservative evangelical Christianity. She grew up in Florida. Her parents are quite conservative. She grew up in churches, you know, all of that. And so I wanted to do that because I think it's a universal or near universal experience. But more than that, I wanted religion and faith to function the same way that sexuality functions actually in this novel, which is to say, I wanted to give it a lot of shades of gray and to not make anything binary. You know, we tend to fall into these, you know, habits of reducing everything to a black and white. So, you know, a religious quote unquote person behaves this way. Right. And, or in order to make these choices, you must be a person who has no morals or has no relationship to God. So I wanted to just layer on all these shades of gray and to let Merritt wrestle with the truth of who she is and the complexity of all of that. And for Merritt, the thing that was important to me in this novel that I didn't want to be too heavy-handed about was that there is a sense in which Merritt's growing relationship with Jane mirrors her relationship to God. And it's really tricky because I'm talking about, you know, a lesbian romance. I'm talking about infidelity. So it's a tricky place to go. But when Merritt connects to the divine as she has in her life, not in the context of her parents, you know, church and religion, but with her own separate relationship with God, when she connects to that same feeling when she's painting and when she feels alive doing that, it parallels how she feels when she connects with Jane. And in all three of those situations, what Merritt is doing is experiencing the fullness of being alive and feeling just electrified with existence. And I think it's just what we experience in life, that there are people who take us outside of ourselves, who create this transcendent experience. Creativity does that too. And a relationship with God does that. And I wanted to look at all of those in this novel and say, what are the things that make people, humans, women, come alive. And I can't, it's hard for me, and this is revealing my own lens and point of view. It's hard for me to say that in one of these instances, the feeling that you get in a church, that's something that we need to like cultivate and pursue. But the feeling we feel pursuing art or how we feel in love, that those are somehow inferior. I wanted to say they're all the same experience. Let's look at it. Let's see what makes us feel that way. And so that's what Merritt does.
I really feel like it made it a much richer novel and just more complicated. I love complication. I want to, before we go to the speed round, I want to end on a little less heavy note. And that is just the sensuality of this novel. There are so many smells and tastes, like there's these meals that I desperately want to be a part of. I want to come to San Francisco and eat all this great food. Can you talk just briefly about sort of how you envision and the smell, the taste, the feel of a scene, and then sort of work those details into the writing?
Yeah, it's for me, I think when I was writing young adult novels years ago, there's a romantic element in all of them. And it really was tough for me. I knew it in the moment, and I know it looking back, to add that evocative quality, to sort of like have my characters smell each other and, you know, sort of taste each other if they're kissing, you know, and how it feels to be around someone and the meals that they have, as you say. It was a struggle. It always felt a little bit artificial and a little bit constructed. And it wasn't my favorite thing to do. In this novel, by contrast, it happened so organically. And I really believe it arose from the characters themselves, because I got to know these women so well in my brain. I mean, they spoke to me like they were alive. And once I could inhabit them and I could envision them in these restaurants, in Jane's kitchen, making salmon or chicken, you know, or Danish food that she's cooking, I felt their presence, you know, I felt myself there. And so for me, to create the smells and tastes, it came really naturally. And I'll say, not to get too personal, but in my own life, I was writing a lot of this in the beginning of the pandemic in early 2020. And I was stuck alone in my house with a marriage that was not going very well, with three kids who were doing school on Zoom. And I was trying to do my job and write this book. And it was literally the opposite of a crowded restaurant or a delicious meal with exotic ingredients or, you know, incredible sex with this incredible lover. So there was a great degree of wish fulfillment in the writing of this novel also, which I think helps.
Well, we like to end every episode of Inside the Writer's Studio with the same 10 questions. You should be able to answer each of them in just a few words, but hopefully they'll give our listeners a little insight into you and to your writing. So if you're ready, we will begin.
Let's do it.
What word do you love to work into your writing?
I guess I would say metaphor. Okay. I'd like to use them and also use the word metaphor.
What word do you hate to encounter in other people's writing?
Honestly.
Where is your favorite place to write?
A hotel bar.
Where could you never write?
In an office.
To what rule of grammar do you pay least attention?
Run-on sentences.
Oh, yeah. What was the first book you remember reading?
Prince of Tides by Pat Conroy.
What are you reading now?
Waking Up in the Dark by Clark Strand.
What book would you like to have written?
State of Wonder by Ann Patchett. Mm-hmm.
What sort of book would you like to write, but probably never will?
A really delicious thriller with twists and turns.
And finally, what would you like to hear a reader tell you?
That this book saved their life.
This has been Inside the Writer's Studio. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and my guest today has been Lauren McBrayer, whose novel, Like a House on Fire, is available wherever books are sold. Lauren, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Inside the Writer's Studio is sponsored by Bookmarks, a literary nonprofit that runs the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas. and operates a community gathering place and nonprofit independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. To find out more about Bookmarks and all its programs, visit www.bookmarksnc.org. Inside the Writer's Studio is proud to be affiliated with Libro FM. Unlike other audiobook platforms, Libro FM supports your local independent bookstore. Whether you buy a single book or, like me, a monthly subscription, you can link your account to your local store or to Bookmarks to support literary community. For a special two-for-one offer, go to Libro.fm and use the discount code WRITERS. If you've enjoyed Inside the Writer's Studio, please consider leaving a rating or review online at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Inside the Writer's Studio posts new episodes on the 1st and 15th of every month. In our next episode, I'll be talking to L. Casamano, author of the Finley Donovan books. Until then, thanks for listening, and may you read with wonder and write with passion.